Accession number 28361, Reel 59.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 59.
You were saying that you didn't have much to detect mortars with.
No, we had a Green Archer radar, which was the state-of-the-art the mortar detection radar at the time. Which didn't work very well. Okay.
And the Green Archer didn't work terribly.
Didn't work very well, and all it did, the only time I recall it doing anything was during the middle of the night attacks, when it suddenly told us that my brigade headquarters was the likely target of a wave of helicopters which it had spotted, which was entirely a figment of its imagination.
Presumably you could have heard a wave of helicopters from some distance away.
Yes, we could.
On.
We could have done. It was actually quite a clear night. I remember looking up at the stars. There was a pause in the snow showers, and we certainly would have seen them, yeah.
When the attack started, what were you doing? Were you in the headquarters?
I was in my... I puzzled over to where I should go. And I contemplated putting myself behind one of the commanders of a battalion, so I was on hand, but the question was which, and if I was then in the wrong place, A, I'd be without my secure voice comms back to division, the communications might not have been very good anyway, and once I was there, bearing in mind it's the middle of the night, I couldn't then go anywhere else, I'd be stuck there.
Possibly out of contact.
Out of contact, and because I couldn't go wandering around in the night without risking bumping into other people and crossing other people's boundaries and generally making a nuisance for myself.
Might there have been
and there might have been a blue on blue.
Possibility of being bumped off.
Being bumped off. So where I stayed, I reckon, was the right place to be. So I was in the middle of it all, and I was talking to COs direct on the radio, getting information from them on progress. And able to influence things by being able to commit my reserve or change the plan.
What did you have then as your own reserve under your hand?
Well, I had two battalions, effectively. I had two para who were advancing up what was the sort of northern axis between, on their left, three para, and on their right, 4-5 commander, but well back, able to go on to either of their two objectives, which I'd told them that they would be prepared to do. And then in the south I had the Welsh Guards who were able to be brought up onto Mount Harriet should that all go wrong. So I had quite a good reserve.
But these Welsh Guards were that sort of amalgamated?
This was the amalgamated one company.
Did you have any concerns about their possible performance as a result of them being a mixed?
No, not really. I thought they'd be okay. Yeah.
And two para were also in reasonable condition.
Yeah, and I'd met them when they came back to me by helicopter. They were flown over the mountain from one brigade from five brigade to me, and I went and had a chat to them. They seemed in good nick.
And presumably at that time, Chris Keeble was in command.
No, David Chandler. David Chandler was in command. He'd arrived. Yeah.
How did the attack go then? What was the progress? And how did it change as it went along? Because all attacks seem to mutate.
Yes. Well, the starting with my left flank, three para took much longer than they and I had hoped. They alerted the enemy before they got to their position because a chap's trod on a mine, and that blew the whole thing.
It was accidental, isn't it?
It was accidental.
Can't do anything about that.
Can't do anything about that. Yeah. That's just part of life. Yeah. Longdon is a rather narrow feature. I always describe it as rather like being a bowling alley, in that the spine backs tend to form sort of two, not exactly, but two sort of separate walls, and so you're fighting your way down a bowling alley at night, being hit from each side as you go by weapons sighted in defilade. And it was a hard grinding battle for that first company, and the attrition was quite high, so they were losing leaders and chaps as they went along, and so the momentum started going out of it.
What was causing that attrition? Was it the
small arms, mainly small arms.
So it's very close range.
Very close range stuff, and they were losing people quite heavily.
Was it aimed fire, or was it fixed lines?
I think it was both, quite frankly. I think it was both. Now, Hugh's plan was that his, having put one company through part of the way, he'd bring in another one in from a different direction, and he sent them off round his left. But they were in a rather exposed position waiting. They were brought under mortar and artillery fire while they were lying in their sort of waiting position.
Was this the assembly area?
This was their assembly area, yeah, or their FUP. I don't know, probably their FUP. And so they were starting to take casualties there, and it became apparent that bringing them in like that was not going to work. So he brought them back and then pushed them through his leading company to do the next phase. Now, all this took time.
So the attempted left flanking move
wasn't possible. Didn't work. And so
it's back to echelon.
So he's having to do it like that. Yeah. That, of course, took time to bring people back. Took time to rejig the fire plan, and again the fight through the second company again was this grinding forward, very tough fighting.
Were they using the standard fire and move?
Yep, as much as they could. Yes, most definitely.
What constrained them? Was it the ground that would prevent them from using
it? Was the ground, and it was dark. Yes. Communications, leaders were getting knocked out. So other guys had to step in. Platoon commanders were getting wounded. Section commanders were getting wounded or killed. So the old sort of battles descend to platoon and section battles eventually.
What sort of front were they on then? Was that forward company attacking on a two platoon front or a one platoon front?
No, it was a one platoon front.
One platoon front.
Yeah.
So it's very narrow indeed.
Very narrow.
So that would presumably be two sections up and
one
there.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then he'd put another platoon, you know, he'd be dodging his platoons, but they couldn't go side by side like that. It was dodging and
passing round. Yes.
Just almost platoon commanders saying, I'll do this and you do that. I mean, really close stuff. Not much control, quite frankly. It all devolving down to the lower level of command and the initiative and drive of junior leaders and soldiers, but taking a long time.
Of course, they'd shown some of that, hadn't they, at Goose Green when they were.
Well, no,
this was
two para done Goose Green.
This is
three para. First battle.
Yeah. Oh, first in action.
First action, and they lost a lot of people, and so by dawn, they had seized the objective.
Had they inflicted a lot of casualties on the Argentines?
Yes, I don't know how many. A lot, and some of them had pushed off at this stage. You know, when they saw it was going, because they were able to run off the end of the objective and away into the darkness. Yeah.
When Three Pyro were doing this, were they able to use their mortars effectively?
Yeah. They used their mortars. They used their gunners. I mean, Hugh always says the closest artillery that came to him during the night was his own.
Yes.
And not by mistake either. It was
being talked in
and really close. Mm. And the gunners played a terribly important part in the battle.
What about the grenade? Because that's often a weapon at night.
They used grenades. They used bayonets. Mm. It was real close quarter stuff. Mm. And Mackay, of course, won a VC there. His platoon commander was wounded and he took over. And he personally charged this position, killed two or three of the occupants, and was found dead in it the next day. It was what someone described as gutter fighting. Close quarter stuff.
So they got on their objective somewhat behind schedule.
Yeah, sure.
For perfectly understandable.
Perfectly understandable. Reasons. They were there by first light, which is what I wanted. Yeah. Now, they then start coming under fire from observed fire, the chap sitting on Tumbledown, which overlooked Longdon, and they were being, and so the next 2 days until the battle rolled on, they were under artillery fire all the time. Bloody unpleasant.
Was this constant or was it intermittent?
Intermittent. But enough. Because they were firing by then on all the objectives. All the objectives that we had taken came under artillery fire, but they were concentrating on Longdon, because that was the closest to them and the easiest for them to bring down observed fire on.
So they could see better.
They could see better. Yeah.
Was there anything that could be done about that to mitigate or diminish the...
No.
They just had to stick it out.
Had to stick it out.
So this presumably had a knock-on effect on what was happening to the south.
Well, what then... Yes, what happened to the south of them was 4 Fire Command on 2 Sisters. Now, the plan the CO had there was that one rifle company would go approach 2 Sisters, as it implies, 2 features. And it looks quite, they look quite small on a map. And when you look at them from a distance, they're looking like little pimples. And in fact, they are long rock ridges over 1,000 metres each, rock ridge, these sort of crenellated dinosaurs, backbones, I would call them. And the western one, because they're not actually side by side, they're echeloned like that, and that's the western one, and this is the eastern one here. And the western one was to be the objective of one of his rifle companies, X Company, led by a chap called Ian Gardner, who was again a very experienced company commander who'd been awarded a decoration in the Dofar commanding a company about 10 years before. And he was approaching it on foot like this, straight on, while the CO took the other 2 companies round to hit the second one. And his idea was that X Company would take out that one first, and all eyes would be on that from these chaps, thinking, oh, well, that's where they're coming from. And then when he was just about finished, he'd come in like this. And what happened, again, that Clausewitz and his friction stepped in, as he always does, on Herr Clausewitz. Instead of taking 3 hours to get there, he took 6 over some very rough ground. I mean, he was coming down off the slopes of Mount Kent, where there are sort of drops from rocks the height of the ceiling. So, you know, if you get the wrong place,
you've got to go around it.
You've got to go around the rock, and you know, it takes a blow. And they were carrying Milans with all their missiles, so they were very heavily laden. And so they were very late. And
could that have been foreseen, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they'd done recces. They just took longer, you know. I suppose he should have allowed longer. He didn't. He built in quite a big fudge factor. But I mean, for example, they had one chap who sort of fell down one of these things and concussed himself. And then people got separated in the dark going through these bloody great boulders.
Oh, yes, you would. Your formation, if you had any such thing, would be broken up.
He'd broken up. So anyway, and they also had to cross the river. Which I've crossed in daylight, and though it's not a big river, it's about half the width of this room, and in places it's 7 or 8 feet deep. So if you get in the wrong place, you go...
You can be swept away.
You get swept away. Well, it's not a very fast-flowing river, it's more like a ditch, a fast-flowing sort of ditch you get in Somerset, you know, those ones that drain the...
On the levels.
On the levels. Anyway, so it took longer, and he got on the radio to his CEO and said, I'm late. And the CEO said, don't worry, I don't care, just get on with it. Tell me when you're ready to go. I mean, the others were waiting down here by then.
Well, so they were waiting to start the initial...
They were waiting to start... They were going to do the second bit, you see. So they were waiting to start that. When this chap was secure there, they were going to come in.
Yeah.
So they had to lie there for 3 hours waiting. And eventually he got there and started fighting his way up onto his objective, and was doing jolly well, and the CO realised that he couldn't wait until he'd finished. He'd risk there being a clash and just go for it. Otherwise, he could wait another few hours. So he then started the 2 rifle companies were coming up from here, going, and they're going up quite a long open slope, and the lead troop of the left-hand company was spotted by Argentine machine gunners.
What sort of distance do you think? distancing?
I think it was about 300 metres, something like that.
Quite a long distance.
Quite a long distance.
Yes.
Long enough. I mean, I'll tell you what happened. They fire came down and they went to ground. And that was when they started hitting it with artillery. But though it paused, as soon as the program lifted, the guns opened up again. So eventually, one of the troop commanders, a chap called Clive Dytor, who's now actually the headmaster of the Oratory School in Berkshire, got to his feet shouting. He was in Zulu company, Zulus, it was Zulu, which was their sort of battle cry, and started running forward. And his section commanders took up the cry, and the blokes took up the cry, so his troops started going. The rest of the company got to its feet and went. It was the only way you could do it, just get their ASP. And they got in among them with the bayonet. And the whole thing started off again, literally, because of one officer. And the CO had come up at this stage to see what was going on. It was between the two companies at that stage when they started moving. He was nearly had his head taken off by a chap firing a Carl Gustav past his ear at the machine guns. So he was in between, and the companies swept forward onto the crest. That was it. They had the objective. And there's a lot of fighting through afterwards, but they were on the top. So that didn't go to plan, but the CO and the boys, you know, got round it.
Did they suffer a lot of casualties during
no.
the bayonet charge?
No, hardly any. They had very low casualties. I mean, I think they got about 5 or 6 kills, something like that.
But was that, do you think, because of the darkness?
I think darkness and the momentum that they covered that distance. They realised they couldn't just lie there forever. They had to go for it. And I think, you know, a mass of men appearing out of the darkness with their bayonets, to use John, who's it, to use Richard Holmes's phrase, the opposition suddenly remembered an urgent appointment elsewhere.
They were unnerved.
They were unnerved.
Well, this is rather an example which would support Gallieni's principle, wouldn't it, of the flight to the front?
Yes.
The way of surviving the enemy's fire is to minimise the time
you spend covering the distance.
Exposed to it, and therefore get to grips with the enemy as quickly as possible, and the closer you get, the more unnerved the enemy will be.
Sure. Well, they got quite carried away, the companies, because Clive Dytor, I think either he or one of his traps, actually picked up a 50 cal gun still on its tripod, which is quite a heavy beast, and was running forward, firing it from the hip, putting it down and firing. He couldn't fire in the hip, because of the crew, but putting it down and firing and picking it up again, chasing these guys off the position.
That sounds almost like a berserk fury.
It does, actually. But anyway, they...
Human strength.
Human strength. And they sort of did it, and that was it. And so he was then secure, and in good, despite the delays, with good time to go on, but not enough time to leave enough daylight hours.
So he couldn't exploit.
He couldn't exploit, and I stopped him. He said, I'm ready to go. And I said, you're not going, because I checked with my gunners. They hadn't got much ammunition, and really, there was only about... I should say 3 hours of darkness left, and he'd have taken more than that just to get from where he was to tumble down. By the time he sort of organised his attack, he'd be doing it in broad daylight.
Presumably, after something like the bayonet charge, it would take quite a lot of time to actually get people reformed.
Yes, because Clive Dytor said one of his sections went bombing off into the darkness and found people, you know, capped. Brought some chaps back about to three or four hundred yards away from where they were.
Well, they'd just been following their noses.
They'd been following their noses like hounds, you know. And,
and
eventually they got them all together. But that was a very... It was well done. In the south, the attack coming in from the back, as I said, I think, earlier, they took them so much by surprise they were able to advance without being spotted, cancelling targets as they went.
Yes.
And eventually, Peter Babington decided that he'd actually start the battle rather than letting them start it when they spotted him. Wow. And said, right, we'll go for it now. Mm. Started bringing down fire and started telling his chaps to start fighting through, so that they were sort of going first, on the move first.
How close did they get to the enemy before they started that?
About 200 metres.
So there was a silent advance,
yeah,
up 200 metres, then a noisy.
Yeah, then noisy.
Attack.
Yeah. And what that was that it was two companies, one going like that and one in echelon going like that. So they were attacking like that, so they weren't shooting at each other.
Staggered attack.
And of course, in that attack, again, there was an act of gallantry which, in my opinion, deserved more than the chap got, where there was a corporal. The whole of Peter's company was on one radio net. All the section commanders, troop commanders, everyone was on the same net. So God knows how many outstations that is, but quite a few. And so they're all talking to each other. And this chap, this corporal, heard one of the second commanders in another troop on the other side of sort of feature almost saying, "I'm held up by some enemy up ahead of me," and he knew that this other troop was a bit further on. "Can you do anything about it?" So he said, "Okay, I will." So he decided that he'd go forward himself to have a look. So he went forward, taking his radio with him, but leaving the rest of his section behind, and looked round at the corner, expecting of this big sort of rock formation, expecting to find a couple of chaps or a sniper, which is what the chap had said, "I'm held up by a lone rifleman, I can't move." And he actually found about 10 or 12 chaps and a GPMG. So he, in his own words, put on a fresh magazine, got out two grenades, and then he must have been a Catholic, said a Hail Mary, went round the corner, lobbed in the two grenades, and then went in and sorted out everyone who was left, killed everybody, so he thought. And then the guys on the other side put in a couple of 66s into the position which he'd abandoned, and he decided to go back and make certain he'd done the job properly. And there was an Argentine chap still alive who loosed off a burst at him and hit him in both legs, this corporal. He managed to kill him and then got on the radio and said, "Come and get me, I'm wounded." Yeah. And so that was an act of, I should have written him up for a Victoria Cross, in my opinion.
But
you can't. I mean, the write-up was terribly, especially going back. The write-up was, we didn't have, I'll come on to that, we didn't have enough time to get our decorations sorted out properly. And he got an MM, but he should have got more, in my opinion.
You mentioned he said, "Come and get me, I'm wounded." How did the casualty evacuation work in
right.
the night attack?
Well, what happened was that the casualties were, I think I've said it before, but it's worth saying again, I'm pressed upon people, don't stop for casualties, you go on past them. So casualties were left, and if you could, you just jabbed a rifle in with his bayonet.
So you marked the spot.
You marked the guy and went on. And then what happened was that the companies had stretcher bearers who came up and collected, dealt with the guys on the ground, then moved them to somewhere where you could get a helicopter in to pick them up.
Did that work effectively?
Yes, I mean, sometimes you couldn't get the helicopter in for some hours.
But it sounds as though it was all quite chaotic in the forward areas.
Yes, it was.
Once the attack got to within a few hundred metres of the enemy position...
That was it. Now, the casualties had to stay there.
They had to wait until...
They had to wait till they could be lifted out and then, or moved out, and then you could get a helicopter in. But the helicopters came in... I mean, my brigade air squadron came in and evacuated loads of casualties. In fact, I've got an exact figure of how many chaps they took out that night. I'm talking about something like 85 people. And that's coming in at dark to a chap holding a green torch.
Yeah.
And then the casualties are loaded.
Precision flying,
and then loaded in, bringing in GPMG ammunition with them. Yeah. All the helicopters were loaded with boxes and boxes of GPMG ammunition.
What about artillery? Were you able to resupply that as well? Because you were saying that you were running short at the end of the battle.
That, we started the resupply the next morning. But in fact, in the next battle, we actually did a night resupply, which I can come on to. Do you want to cover it now while we think of it?
No, I think we'll
yeah,
do that.
Okay.
So I'm sorry I digressed there by talking about Kazovac when you were describing the southern end of the fighting.
Yeah.
But the Peter Babington's attack apparently went in very successfully in
the
stealth attack, which then became noise at the last minute, because the enemy would then have been confronted front and rear, wouldn't they?
Yes, I mean
what
they perceived as front and rear. In fact, we weren't obviously going to put in gap because you'd get that effect. What then happened is the enemy tried to mount a counterattack on Peter Babington and David Ween's company, who were the ones that were coming in the back, with what wasn't engaged at the sharp end, as it were, their lead company. And then, but artillery fire was brought down on them, they were pinned totally.
Yeah.
And they took, 4-2 Commando took over 400 prisoners. And some of them buggered off. Well, not the four, but, there was something like 600 guys up there. Some of them pushed off, because as the companies came in like that, and they were pinned here, there was a way out over the side like that. They could get off down the feature. But it's a highly, I always regard that attack as a brilliant example of inflicting the maximum damage on the enemy to the minimum damage yourself. They had two men dead and 13 wounded, and they captured a position and they took 400 prisoners in the process.
So in effect they'd taken out a whole battalion.
They'd taken out a battalion position. Yeah.
Do you attribute this to it being a night attack or to the deception or to the manoeuvre? Was there any...
I think it was A, night, and B, the fact that the deception and coming through up the back. Mm. I mean, it was really a combination of... It may have been 18th century, but it was also manoeuvre warfare. I mean, they were doing that.
Well, the 18th century was the era of manoeuvre.
It was manoeuvre. It was doing the manoeuvre that instead of going straight up the middle. I mean, they would have lost many more guys going straight up the middle or up to the front, because all that the Argentine defences were orientated towards somebody coming
toward
from
a frontal attack. It's a rather anti-Clausewitzian. You've been mentioning Clausewitzian to friction, but here, in effect, you were going counter to Clausewitz, who says you can't avoid attrition.
Yes. Well, I think you can avoid attrition. I mean, we're going attrition. I think we're getting into a very interesting area here. We're outside the remit, but since you asked me, I would feel that there may have to be a period of headbutting before you can actually do something clever. And there may also have to be a period of heavy fighting if the chap stays where he is.
By the end of the night, were you satisfied with what had happened?
Very, very. It was a great feeling. I mean, the only thing then was that, of course, everyone now was under artillery fire from the enemy, because they were now within range.
So you've got an intermediate objective, but you really couldn't stay there.
Couldn't stay there for too long. I wanted to go on the next day, the next night. And we were all ready to go. In fact, two para had moved into a position behind Longdon, which is where I told them they were to go, because their next move was to hook around Longdon, not to follow on the way three para had been going, but to do a swing round the top from a different direction to take Wireless Ridge, while 5 Brigade did tumble down and Mount William. But what happened was that two things. One was that as 5 Brigade were having their O group the next morning, my logistic regiment commander, Ivor Helberg, who found himself, poor chap, not only being a brigade logistic regiment commander, but being a divisional logistic regiment commander without any extra assets, attended the O group and said to the brigade commander, "You realize that you have no ammunition on your gun lines. Are you really..." I don't know his exact words were, but "Are you really going to do an attack tonight without any artillery?" So that persuaded him that he needed perfectly reasonably another 24 hours to bring up gun ammunition, and of course to restock ours too.
Had you got any gun ammunition left?
Oh, we had a bit. And we were down to sort of 10, 15 rounds of gun, something like that.
Well, that's enough for one pop, isn't it?
That was enough for just one fire mission. Yeah. That's it. So, if that. And the other thing was that the CO of the Scots Guards, Mike Scott, persuaded Tony Wilson that the axis that he'd been given was just crazy, because the axis he'd been given for his attack was up the main track, which led into the arms of two separate battalion positions, which was sighted rather like a banana. You had Tumbledown here and Mount William there, and you were going to stick your head straight into that.
So in effect you'd be going into a sort of crescent of defensive fire.
Exactly. So he said, why don't I have a diversionary attack up the main track, which is what they expect, and I will mount my attack. And I come into the picture there, as I said to Tony, you know, it's not me to tell you how to run your brigade, dear boy, but wouldn't you rather do your attack from 4-2's position, which is here? They'll secure your start line for you, and then you'll be attacking them like that, not into there.
So it'd be an oblique.
An oblique. Okay. So he said, yes, I think I'd better do that. So Mike Scott said, I'd like to spend the day looking at the ground. So he went up and did that. So that added another 24. So eventually the next attack was 48 hours instead of 24 hours later.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 60.